Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. The news this week is totally occupied by the American defeat in Afghanistan. It is both a retreat and a defeat. It is, in my opinion, not only the worst defeat of the United States in the last century, but it has very serious implications for Israel. Israel's former Foreign Minister Moshe Arens famously said that Israel is a nice place in a bad neighborhood, and that neighborhood has become much worse and much more dangerous for two reasons. First of all, we have a new neighbor here in the Middle East, Afghanistan, which is controlled by a radical Muslim group. And this new hostile neighbor now has lots of new military equipment that was provided by the United States that simply left millions of dollars of equipment in the hands of our enemies. And secondly, and just as bad, if not worse, is the fact that the present American administration has proven to be weak, and much worse, it has no qualms about abandoning its allies and those who have been loyal to the United States. This throws a great responsibility upon our government to do what is necessary to defend Israel, no matter what the United States, whether it approves or not. The actions of the United States were strategically wrong, raised the danger to the Western world of fanatic Islamism. But to Israel, this is much more. To Israel, this is an existential problem. We need a strong government here in Israel. That in itself is a problem because the president and government of Israel is a collection of parties, many of whom have basic disagreements with others. We are indeed living in very difficult times, which have become even more difficult and dangerous this week. Let's pray that our leaders will know how to navigate through these difficult waters. I'll be back after the break.
The return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel was prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago and is coming true today. Shalom. Join me, Josh Wander, on Israel Unplugged. Listen in as we delve into the spiritual and physical aspects of the Jewish return to Zion. We'll discuss the biblically mandated, historic, and of course practical understandings of this incredible transition from exile to redemption. That's Israel Unplugged, every Monday on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. As the listeners know, I generally don't speak about foreign affairs, only as they touch upon Israel. Primarily because I'm certainly not an expert. I have no inside information. I only know what I read and what I see on television or hear on the radio. But I want to say something because of what's happening with the Americans in Afghanistan. First of all, the United States is our closest ally. We never asked the United States to fight for us. All we ask is they give us the weapons and we will defend ourselves. We also supply the United States with a lot of information, not only about what's happening in our area, but we improve our weapons and we improve the weapons they give to us or sell to us, and we let them know about these improvements. So our relationship with the United States is quite mutual. Our strength in the United States is not in the presidency, it's in our relationship with the two houses of Congress. And now there's a problem coming because there is a group in Congress known as the Squad, which is not only anti-Israel, I also believe it to be anti-Semitic, and I also believe it to be anti-American, and it is growing in strength. Now, taking all these things into consideration, we have to see what the United States did in Afghanistan to see how this reflects upon the future and our reliance on the United States. Our prime minister went to meet with the American president last week, and they said a lot of nice words, but the bottom line is, where do we really stand? America has unconditionally surrendered Afghanistan to terrorists, and what it has done is really set the world back decades and has put every human being on the planet into more danger than it was just 2 weeks ago, particularly Israel. Islamic terrorists around the world have been invigorated and emboldened. Some 5,000 terrorists were released from prison in Afghanistan, substantially increasing the likelihood of attacks on American targets and on targets of friends of America. America's enemies will no longer fear the world's most powerful nation, and her allies wonder if they are being betrayed. The hasty departure was a combination of incompetence and lack of faith. The Taliban turned Biden's self-imposed deadline into an absolute demand and then threatened serious consequences for any violation. Biden was unwilling to confront that threat. His capitulation speaks about it represents abject cowardice and dereliction of duty as commander-in-chief. There are even those in America who say that he should be impeached. And I've heard some members of Congress and some former members of the American military that as commander-in-chief, the president should be subjected to court-martial. I don't know exactly how that works, but just the fact that they use those words means that there's very little faith in the American president, even by people in the United States. So what happens is his capitulation shows that America is not the America that it was in the past. The departure from Afghanistan was an unconditional surrender to a bunch of barbaric terrorists. Biden's actions have done harm to America's credibility and deterrence, and his friends are now much more worried. At the end of the attack, I saw this on television, he said, "We will hunt you down and make you pay." That simply rings hollow. Nobody believes him. The overarching duty of any president is to protect American citizens. But now, apparently, there are a lot of Americans being left in Afghanistan, and Biden has essentially signed a death warrant. Who knows how many Americans are left there? And also thousands of Afghans who supported the Americans now are in danger for their lives. Perhaps this is a terrible policy failure. And you look at the people now surrounding the U.S. president, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, is certainly a willing conspirator in pulling out like this in a really baseless way, really very bad. The United States has stood as the bulwark of freedom in the world, and the actions of this president over the last two or three weeks shows that we no longer can rely on the America as we relied in the past. Now, there is no doubt that we in Israel can defend ourselves. And luckily, as I understand it, there is a close relation between American military people and Israeli military people. But in the final analysis, the world looks to the United States, and by this hasty pullout and retreat from Afghanistan, all of America's allies are looking askance at the United States, which means they're also looking in other directions for support. For example, the Saudi Arabians have just signed an agreement with Russia dealing with their military material and things of that nature. In other words, the world in general, the free world as we know it, is now turning away from the United States because they simply do not feel they can rely on the United States as they did in the past, despite all the proud words and all the claims. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. And what the United States did in Afghanistan shows that it is rapidly turning into a paper tiger. Incidentally, it could well be that the American president chose August 31st as the date to get out of Afghanistan for purely political reasons. He wanted something to brag about on the 20th anniversary of the attack on the United States on the infamous 9/11. September 11th this year will celebrate the Taliban will celebrate its victory over the United States, and that's a huge difference after 20 years. Whether the United States should have remained in Afghanistan for 20 years or not, after they accomplished their original mission, that's something for the experts to talk about. Certainly something that I have no expertise. But the Americans went there to get rid of the source of Islamic terrorism. They accomplished the job very rapidly. Maybe they should have gotten out then. It's too late now to discuss it. So the bottom line is that the free world is finding that it may no longer depend on the United States as it has done in the past. Incidentally, based upon the results of the visit of our prime minister to the United States, it's pretty obvious that the current U.S. administration does not prioritize the Middle East, and in that sense, it's very similar to the Trump administration and even the Obama administration. In recent years, the United States has been in a clear process of retreat from its role as the world's policeman in favor of an inward-looking approach. Washington is now much less focused on global politics, particularly in the difficult neighborhood of the Middle East. President Biden was focused on China. Now it's hard to say what will be after what happened in Afghanistan. The U.S. is disengaging from the Middle East, and that represents itself a big problem for Israel. And the shameful withdrawal from Afghanistan is the writing on the wall. The American tiger no longer roars. It's behaving like a world power in retreat, perhaps even entering the twilight of that power. And Israel's fate is tied to America's fate. This is the reality with Israel must now contend. The waning of American power and the surge of the Islamic camp, particularly in this region. This will make Israel more isolated at the strategic level. So there's nothing to do with the Palestinian question or the peace process. They're secondary issues in comparison to the enormous existential challenges Israel is now facing. And these are the facts on the ground. I'll be back after the break.
Hi, I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Matt Zucker.
Join us for Lighten Up, where we take a look at the week's current events in Israel and from around the Jewish world through a humorous lens.
If you've been paying attention during these crazy times, you know that it's a challenge to parody life anymore. But join Steve and I as we give it the old college try. Not only is being happy an obligation, but life is just too short to take it all so seriously.
So join me, Steve Miller.
And me, Matt Zucker.
For Lighten Up every Monday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 p.m. Israel, only on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about a new form of anti-Semitism. Jews are accused of being white. It's an attack upon Jews. They're accused of being white. You hear endless variations on this idea during Israel's recent war with Hamas. All kinds of lawmakers and intellectuals and entertainers took to social media to denounce the world's only Jewish state of perpetuating apartheid or of murdering black and brown people. You even hear it from radical Jewish advocates who say that Jews are passed as white or functionally white, which means they should take their place among the world's most privileged, no matter what might have happened to them, like in the Holocaust. They're still among the world's most privileged, according to this accusation of being white. You hear it in colleges. There are even courses like Jews and Racial Privilege. Now, there are those who simply insist that viewing the world and its inhabitants through the lens of race is just something that goes back to the 19th century, primarily based in Germany. Now, you could marshal people like Martin Luther King to your defense, and what counts is the content of character over color of skin. That makes sense. But you won't get very far with that argument against people for whom race alone shapes every thread of human experience. Only race counts to these people. Now, you can also argue that the category white is ridiculous. Jews stand out not because they're white. The Jews really stand out because they don't fit in. Is Judaism a religion? Yes. Are Jews a nation? Yes. Do we share genetic traits? Yes. Do we come in all shapes, sizes, and skin colors? Yes. This kind of image that black Jews and white Jews and European Jews and African Jews and educated wealthy Jews and barely literate poor Jews all understanding one another perfectly because they belong to the same strange family. You can go into a synagogue anywhere, in Marrakesh, in Geneva, in Hong Kong, or New York, and you'll see all kind of people look different, wildly different, and you can rest assured that when services start, they'll all recite in more or less the same fashion the ancient words the Jews have spoken for millennia. There is a specialist, in an anthropologist who works in the United Nations. His name is Jose Martinez Cobo, and he discusses what makes people indigenous. He argued that people and nations should display one or more of the following to be the same: occupation of ancestral lands, common ancestry, a shared culture or religion, and a shared language. By any and all these measurements, archaeology, history, theology, and even DNA tests, Jews, if anything, are an indigenous people to the land of Israel, from which they may have been exiled 2,000 years ago, but they always planned and prayed to return. Now, this leaves progressives with a problem. To admit that there is something unique about Jews, to not conform to the dogmas of what's called intersectionality and white privilege, and all these semi-coherent mutterings at the core of their monstrous woke religion, and it introduces doubt into their new belief. To ease their tensions and keep their faith alive, they resort to a simple pronouncement that flattens all the differences and erases all difficulty. They say Jews are white, and they say this in an accusing manner. The creative genius of Jew hatred has always been its ability to imagine the Jews the embodiment of whatever it is that polite society finds repulsive. That's why Jews are either condemned as being bankers controlling all the world's money. So they shout the Jews are white. All that matters is the argument that for the last few decades, American Jews have benefited from the rewards that come from being among society's most educated and best compensated few. It's true. 4 in 10 Jews live in households making more than $100,000 a year, more than any other religious group in America, which is an astounding statistic when you consider that the Jews constitute less than 2% of the population. This doesn't take into account that, according to a recent survey by the Harry and Jeanette Weinberg Foundation, 16 to 20% of American Jewish households earn less than $30,000 a year. The argument of particular privilege is especially spurious because it ignores the unique nature of anti-Jewish bigotry. The problem is that Jews don't really fit comfortably into any of the categories that the ideologies have created to make sense of human diversity. Jews are just Jews. This is a difficult realization that has driven haters to distraction throughout the generations. It's why the Jews alone have been singled out for a specific kind of steady stream of suspicion and persecution throughout history, even in America. It's a torrent that hasn't grown any weaker. In 2019, for example, nearly two-thirds of all religious-based hate crimes in America targeted Jews, a 14% increase from the previous year. So the Jews are accused of just about everything. The Jews take the shape of whatever the Jew hater fears and loathes most. And if you decide there's such a thing as whites, and that the whites are uniquely responsible for all the evils perpetrated on the innocent and downtrodden, well, Jews must not only be among the white, but they should be really nestled comfortably at the top of the white supremacist pyramid. Now, you can argue about that. There are three misfortunes. First, those Jews who accept the mantle of whiteness have quite literally lost track of time and space. Rather than admit that the arc of history is long and often bends toward anti-Semitism, it is a clear pattern that emerges when you study any period of history in any corner of the earth. You Jews are blamed for whatever it is that it seems worthy of blame at the time. This stance is aligned with culture and politics that praise radical individualism over anything else. Nearly two-thirds of Americans told pollsters they had faced Jews. They had experienced anti-Semitism. Just as black intellectuals who go against the narrative of race are discounted and for failing to be black in the correct manner, so are Jews who share their plight dismissed as whiners who fail to see the bigger picture of oppression and their shameful place in it because Jews are white. So the Jews who want not to be attacked essentially denied their whiteness. If some of these Jews would save, they could save themselves from ignorance and they'd learn more about what it really means to be Jewish, in a Jewish way. Nearly a third of American adults, they define themselves as spiritual but not religious. In other words, they admit to being Jewish, but they're not religious. They're Jews in spirit. They ignore the fact that religion emerged in precisely the same way across cultures, precisely because humans realized that spiritual stirrings alone were meaningless unless tethered to the ground by rituals that had to be performed together with other people. In other words, being Jewish isn't just saying I'm Jewish, it's acting in a Jewish way. Being all too human, progressive Jews are eager to belong to something, but they don't want to belong to being Jewish. So you have a lot of Jews who are accepting this terrible accusation that Jews are white. Nothing good ever came to Jews from groveling. We survive because we do not grovel. We are what we are. And that is what Jews should always be. According to the latest Pew survey, only 3% of Jews 65 and older define themselves as observant, while among adults under 30, the number rises to 17%, which means Jews are getting back to being Jewish and not just being white. I'll be back after the break.
Are you tired of political correctness and the fear that you might offend someone?
I'm not afraid to offend you.
Wow, look who's talking tough.
One has to be tough to keep sane today.
Hi, I'm Alan Skorsky.
And I'm Bayla Seabrow.
And join us every Wednesday for The Definitive Wrap as we interview the most sought-after guests and expose progressive trends that masquerade as enlightenment but actually destroy our freedoms.
We are the No Woke Zone, so buckle up to this exciting show.
Buckling up, but I'm driving.
Sure, you can drive, but I'm the navigator.
Tune in for the No Nonsense, The Definitive Wrap Show, every Wednesday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. There's something very important happening under the radar, and it's not being noticed. The future of Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital is being attacked by the Biden administration. The Biden administration has been pushing both publicly and privately to open a U.S. consulate in Jerusalem aimed at serving the Palestinians. If such a move is allowed to take place, it would not only be a slap in the face to Israel, it would serve to encourage greater extremism by stoking misguided Palestinian hopes of obtaining a foothold in our capital city. Nearly 4 years ago, in December 2017, the Trump administration took the historic step of acknowledging history, acknowledging reality, and acknowledging destiny when it granted official U.S. recognition to Jerusalem as the capital of the Jewish state. After the U.S. Embassy was formally inaugurated in May 2018, the separate American consulate in the city, which was tasked with dealing with the Arabs, was closed down and subsequently absorbed into the embassy, where it is now known as the Palestinian Affairs Unit. This was a proper and logical thing to do. After all, it made no sense to have a freestanding American diplomatic office on Israeli soil dealing with a foreign entity such as the Palestinian Authority. Submitting it under the auspices of the embassy was a sensible, appropriate, cost-effective, and legal thing to do. But now the Biden administration wants to turn back the clock on the move, signaling an openness to dividing Jerusalem. On May 25th this year, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken visited Ramallah. He informed Palestinian Chairman Mahmoud Abbas of the U.S. decision to reopen an American consulate in Jerusalem that would handle Palestinian matters. Now, this might seem trivial to some people, but to view it in such manner would be a grave mistake. Symbols matter, especially in diplomacy and international affairs, and there can be no doubt what a new U.S. consulate in Jerusalem aimed at the Palestinians would signify. Nir Barakat, the former mayor of Jerusalem, said the act of establishing a Palestinian consulate in Jerusalem means recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. The administration's consent on this matter is disastrous, and I myself intend to aggressively fight this dangerous decision. Unless there be any doubt as to how the Palestinians are interpreting the proposed move by the Americans, consider the following. On the day following Blinken's announcement, Hassan El-Sheikh, a member of the Fatah Central Committee, told Palestinian television that the U.S. announcement was a clear message that Eastern Jerusalem is part of the occupied Palestinian territories. Similarly, a website called Al Monitor reported on June 1st that a political advisor in the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs insisted that decision confirms that East Jerusalem is part of the occupied Palestinian territory and is the capital of Palestine and remains subject to final negotiations, unquote. Consequently, the Biden administration has succeeded in reigniting the Palestinian illusion that they will gain control over Jerusalem, which is a fantasy that only serves to feed greater extremism and greater rejectionism. Fortunately, due to international law, the United States cannot unilaterally undertake such a measure. Doing so would require Israel's consent. Former Ambassador Alan Baker, who was the legal advisor of the foreign ministry here, explained in a paper published last month, the declared intention to reopen the former consulate general raises complex legal and political questions. According to the 1963 Vienna Convention of Consular Relations, Baker pointed out that a consular post or any other offices forming part of a consular post may only be established in the territory of the receiving state with that state's consent. Clearly, reopening the former consulate in Jerusalem, the jurisdiction of which would be intended to cover relationships with the Palestinian leadership and also with other Palestinian governmental bodies and Palestinian residents, none of which are subject to Israel's sovereignty. Such a move would be politically and legally very problematic. Another compelling case against the Biden administration's plan to open a consulate in Jerusalem was made by former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman. He was the ambassador in the Trump administration. He wrote that he wrote back in May that a U.S. consulate in Jerusalem to a foreign body other than Israel clearly runs afoul of American law. It would be illegal and unwise. Friedman rightly points out that the location of the consulate in Jerusalem would be perceived as a de facto location of a future embassy. That would be a huge and unwarranted gift for the Palestinian leadership, who continue to pay terrorists in violation of American law and universal principles of morality. And such a move would show none of the attributes necessary for peaceful coexistence in this region. He said if they put an American consulate in Jerusalem, it would set forth facts on the ground that will guarantee the failure of any future peace negotiations, unquote. So, for all these reasons, Israel must stand firm on this issue, and Israel must reject any request by Washington to open a separate consulate for Palestinians in the city of Jerusalem, in any part of the city of Jerusalem. We cannot and we must not agree to allow the Biden administration to lay the groundwork for dividing the city of Jerusalem, which is our eternal capital. And of course, it's pretty obvious that no other country in the world would even consider consenting to such a step, which would only undermine the international legitimacy of the rightful claim of Israel to our own capital. Israel cannot consent to such an act. Now, one of the problems about this issue is not the issue itself, but the fact that it doesn't appear in the headlines because of other things that are happening around the world, particularly what's happening in Afghanistan. That is swallowing up all the news headlines. And by the way, the whole Afghanistan retreat by the United States has showed the world a tremendous American weakness that couldn't even have been imagined even 10 years ago. After the Second World War, the United States became really the citadel and the fortress of democracy. I think the United States may have made some mistakes when it interfered in other areas. There was a Korean War, there was a Vietnam War, there's this war in Afghanistan, which has lasted longer than any other foreign war that the United States has been engaged in. But if you look back, just as does the Korean incident, the North Koreans attacked the South Koreans, and the United States went to the aid of South Korea. And in retrospect, you look back, you see what it ended up by keeping the Koreans divided, which they were to begin with, and they allowed the South Koreans to establish a flourishing democracy. And as far as Vietnam is concerned, I really can't say anything. I'm not an expert on foreign affairs, But the Americans were eventually kicked out. And now all of Vietnam is under communist rule. That's a story unto itself. But the bottom line is that since the Second World War and the Korean War, the United States has made a very large number of mistakes. The problem is that this current mistake, the way it's shown to be weakened in Afghanistan, base is going to be established for terrorism, this is a mistake which is going to have an influence, a negative one, on the entire area, including Israel. So I think it's a good time to tell the Americans that our capital is our capital and does not belong to anybody else. Having said all that, take care of yourselves. Jay Shapiro signing off. Until next week.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom! Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.